CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Now, the first segment of our show is a post-dated one, folks, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Jennifer Roy and Kathy Goetz will be telling us a little bit about Dysphonia International. So what can you tell me about Dysphonia International?
Sure. So Dysphonia International was founded in 1989. It was actually founded as the National Spasmodic Dysphonia Association, where we focus mainly on spasmodic dysphonia, which is a fairly rare neurological voice condition. And about 3 years ago, we changed the name to Dysphonia International to better represent all voice conditions, with still a focus on research for spasmodic dysphonia. The reality is we were already supporting people with other voice conditions, and we were already reaching out internationally. So this name just better represents the organizations and the services that we provide. And our main goals are to fund seed grants to advance research in voice conditions and spasmodic dysphonia, education and outreach so that the public has a better understanding of what it's like to live with a voice condition, and support people who are already living with a voice condition or newly diagnosed. And Jennifer and Kathy do a wonderful job leading our local support group. We have local support groups in the U.S. and Canada, along with area contact leaders throughout the world.
So, how does dysphonia typically affect a person? What are some of the common symptoms?
You can't talk. And it's not due to laryngitis or a cold.
So, can you tell me a little bit about your diagnosis journeys? What was it like for you going through the process of finding out that you had a rare condition?
I'll start. It took me 2.5 years to be diagnosed, and that was 7 specialists and 7 speech therapists before I was diagnosed and able to get treatment. So it was a horrible 2.5 years, during which time I was unable to even consider working because I couldn't say my name and be understood.
So, is there ever a risk of go ahead.
Oh, I just would share mine quickly. First I want to say that there are 2 types of SD. So, Jennifer has the one type, and I have the other type. So, but my journey was, I was 6 months without a voice, and I was an elementary school principal, so that made it tricky, but I kept working. I was fortunate. I had a great staff and employer. The only kind of issue that I really had was I had no answers. I've been to a ENT, ears, nose, throat specialist, and he just said, you have to get into the functions lab in London, and there you'll learn more. And for 6 months, I waited to get in, thinking the worst, because he didn't offer any insights. He just said, I have to get to the functions lab. So your brain does terrible, mean things. And 30 seconds of meeting Dr. McBride, who diagnosed me, when he heard me trying to talk, he said, I know what you've got. We're gonna do a couple of things back in my office. But he said, it's going to be fine. And I'm like, started crying, because you just think the worst.
So is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis for SD?
It's very high. A lot of people go misdiagnosed or undiagnosed. The biggest challenge is general practitioners aren't very familiar with it, nor are general ears, nose, throat doctors, otolaryngologists. That's one of the things that we're trying to change, especially with the otolaryngologists, because they're treating ears, nose, and throat. But there is subspecialties of a laryngologist that just focuses on the voice. And for a long time, there still isn't a lot of them, but there has been an influx of new laryngologists that are helping to diagnose people quicker. And the other bigger challenge is there's no tests for diagnosis. You can't do a brain scan, an MRI, it doesn't show up in blood work. Usually it's an elimination of other voice issues like lesions, nodules, and such. And, you know, there's still disagreement on the diagnosis, even by the experts. So I think all of that gets compounded. For a long time, GERD was the misdiagnosis of the day. People were getting treated for acid reflux when really they had a voice condition. So diagnosis is high. Or misdiagnosis is high, I'm sorry.
Well, and I think the other part of the problem is that as a result of the voice condition, we can develop other voice conditions, including, in particular, muscle tension, which makes the symptoms even worse. And it's a form of compensating to try and use what voice we don't have. Sure. And it's a much more common condition, but I was treated for muscle tension for over, 2.5 years. And I kept going back and saying, I'm doing the speech therapy for it. I spent $10,000 on speech therapy and it didn't help.
So,
yeah, you could have, as Kathy mentioned, there's two forms of spasmodic dysphonia. The more common one is adductor, AD, where the vocal folds are slamming together, making it very difficult to get words out. And the other form is AB, abductor, where the vocal folds are pulled apart and they're not touching, which causes a very breathy, whispery voice. And as Jennifer mentioned, you can have multiple voice conditions. So there are people who have both AB and AD. It's rare, but it happens, along with muscle tension dysphonia, along with vocal tremor. So that can really complicate teasing out what is what. And then sometimes when you treat one thing like with spasmodic dysphonia, if you have vocal tremor, you treat the spasmodic dysphonia, and that gets under control, but then your vocal tremor is more prominent because that can't really be treated as well. So it does complicate, and symptoms can vary across the board. I mean, that's everyone is very unique in their voice condition.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for awareness of this condition, what would you say?
Be persistent if whatever treatment you're being given is not working. And be persistent and go back and let them know. And also I think we have to advocate for ourselves to get to the right person even though, as Kim mentioned, the specialists for diagnosing voice problems are few and far between. The last that I read or heard about, Kim, correct me, but I think it was like 50% of people with some form of spasmodic dysphonia, for an example, are undiagnosed. Would that
be? Yeah, we don't have good epidemiology, but I mean, there's a lot of undiagnosed people, especially if it's a mild case, because they just figured, okay, this is how I sound now.
Like to thank you all for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Cam, can I add one more thing about what we would like people to know?
Sure.
I think it's important that people not judge the sound of the person's voice, because you don't really know what's going on with somebody, and really, it can be almost an invisible disorder. So if Jennifer or Kathy were walking down the street and you passed them, you wouldn't even know there was something wrong until they spoke. And the judgment, I think, is very challenging. So I don't mean to speak on your behalf, but from what I've heard so many times, there's that. So ask what's wrong.
There's also a fear that we are contagious.
Yeah.
So, my name is Melissa Seawater. I founded MultiplyBy1.org in 2022. We are a national nonprofit, actually international, founded in Canada for trauma and dissociative disorders and their loved ones. And we offer various services, which, you know, we've got to talk about today.
And you, Ian?
Not a ton to know about me. Yeah, my name is Ian Rawson. I joined the org, I think, in 2023, and then I became president last summer. It's been a great experience. I guess we can talk about more.
So, the organization itself, what sorts of supports do you provide to those who have experienced trauma or who have a dissociative disorder?
So, we started off, our first service was online support groups for those with dissociative disorders and loved ones. They run weekly at a certain time. And I have two hosts around the call. So it's a peer support run by people with various qualifications and often are also peers themselves. We started up Real Life Mason magazine, it's digital and print, in November of 2022, so a few months later. And you know, we eventually had the directory of therapists for our screening for their knowledge and awareness of trauma and dissociative disorders. And it's kind of a bit of a list at this point. We've kind of run the gamut in a short time and have a lot to, in the works, I guess.
So, for those who might not be as familiar with how a dissociative disorder affects a person, could you tell us a little about that?
Sure. There's a four classifications, or I guess, dissociative disorders known now in the DSM, Diagnostic Statistic Manual. There's this depersonalization, which is feel like disconnected from your own existence or reality of self, I guess, in a sense, like a derealization or depersonalization is like, I am not real. I feel like I am a ghost. I feel like, a consciousness floating through the world of my body. Derealization is feeling the world isn't real or not quite right. Kind of distorted, like a painting, it's not quite right. And then there's also dissociative identity disorder, or OSDD, where there's different states of self, and all these are considered trauma disorders on a spectrum of complex post-traumatic stress. So they are a reaction to traumatic experience.
So, how do you reach out to folks who could potentially benefit from having that support and knowing they're not alone in facing these disorders?
We've been kind of fortunate in the sense of people find us. We built a website and, you know, presented the services and, you know, built it up in a way that was, you know, inclusive of everyone, that was, you know, considering all angles of well-being and, you know, need. And, you know, once that hits Google and there's so little out there, such an underserved community, they will find it and they will talk about it and they'll spread the word. So a lot of it is, you know, search engines, word of mouth, referrals.
So this next question is for both of you. Do you find there are any challenges in supporting those affected by these traumatic circumstances and these conditions?
Well, one of the easiest things, which I think would be a simpler way to start to launch into the challenges, one of the easier things is just talking about common experience and when you have a group of people who you know all have suffered similar experiences or all have similar struggles, a lot of times we have a hard time communicating our struggles to people that don't experience them. So just being able to, you know, discuss our experiences with people who inherently get it is something that makes it easy. What makes it difficult can be, unfortunately, a lot of stuff. You know, it's hard to dive into really deep or disturbing territory, because obviously we don't want to trigger or upset anyone else. But at the same time, a lot of times that's the stuff that we need to talk about. Like that's the stuff that people are coming together to discuss and do real healing over. So that can be a challenge to navigate.
So for each of you, in your time with the organization, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
That would be hard to choose. I think that even the small things that are actually, you know, very significant are success stories. Individuals who might say, you know, because of these groups, I want to live now. Because of these groups, I have hope, and I saw the people who have, you know, thought futures when I thought I had none, and I went out and got my future. I went out and started volunteering. I started aspiring and being, you know, a person and that you know, hopes and wants things and believes in themselves. You know, there's so many victories within each person that it's hard to quantify exactly what you consider success.
Oh, is there one from your standpoint, Ian?
I mean, I would have to agree. You know, I'm involved in multiple groups a week, and I mean, every day is victory. You know, people have breakthroughs. People have personal growth. Yeah, like Melissa, it would be really, really hard to pick just one. Anytime that we're seeing people get the support that they need, get real healing, achieve personal growth. I mean, even just myself, my journey with the org has been full of personal victories, and I've seen the personal victories of a lot of other people as well. So it would be hard to quantify one. I consider the org itself to be a massive victory.
Like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hey, I'm a member of ArtSight Inc., Windsor's only nonprofit artist-run center. It's a space that invites artists across all levels of their artistic practice. We're moving out of our legendary space in downtown Windsor to create a new legendary existence on Droulard. We're fundraising for this huge transition to help ArtSight grow and build on our commitment to the cause of showcasing contemporary works. We'll have a bigger building with two exhibition spaces for presenting works from both local and visiting artists while working to expand on our community events and programming. Join us in our cause by heading over to artsiteinc.ca/donate or gofundme.com/artsiteinc. Thank you.
Welcome back to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells, Earlier in our show, we heard from Melissa Seawater and Ian Rawson about Multiplied by One, and Kathy Goetz and Jennifer Roy told us about Dysphonia International. This next interview was a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Brent Wolf will be telling us about ATRA. So what can you tell me about ATRA?
That is a big opening question. So what I can tell you about ATRA is the American Therapeutic Recreation Association, and it is the professional membership organization that represents the interests of recreational therapy. We are the only national organization that does this for the United States, and our primary role in what we do is to make sure that we are the mouthpiece, the voice of recreational therapists, and that we are educating individuals on recreational therapy, and that we are making sure that people understand what we do, the importance of what we do as well. Our mission is to empower recreational therapists, and we do that through our advocacy efforts, through our education efforts, and through our connection efforts. And so we work very hard to live that mission on a daily basis as we try to empower recreational therapists in those ways and make sure that people are understanding what we do. It's so funny how many times people say, you know, I tell them I'm a recreational therapist, and they have just no idea what that means. And I think that's what ATRA is really we're trying to do, is being that voice for the profession. We have our vision is to live in a world, to help create a world where everybody who needs recreational therapy has access to recreational therapy. And we know we don't live in that world right now, that we have lots and lots of people that could benefit from recreational therapy services that are not able to access those for a variety of different reasons. And so we work hard to live that mission, to empower recreational therapists and to help create that world where everybody who needs recreational therapy has access to recreational therapy. So that's a kind of a big picture nutshell, I guess, a little bit about what ATRA is.
So for those who might not be as familiar with what recreational therapy can encompass, can you tell me about some of the branches there?
Yeah, absolutely. So recreational therapy, I kind of describe it as we use the things that people enjoy to help them get better. At the basis level, we are looking at how do we find the activities, the things that you like to do, to try and use those as our means of treatment to help you improve maybe physical skills, or maybe it is your social abilities, your social interaction skills, or maybe it's emotional skills and coping. But we're using recreation activities to try and help people improve their overall quality of life. We do this through a ton of different types of interventions. We use adventure therapy. That's one that I've used extensively in my practice is adventure therapy. We use stress management, anger management, animal-assisted therapy. But we're doing activities within each of these that are allowing us to help our clients address their assessed needs and what it is that they need to try and work on and try and improve. And so we work with clients across, I use the term clients, but people across kind of the disability span. And so people with any kind of disabling condition, is somebody that a recreational therapist could work with. And that is a broad definition of disability as well, I would say. I think that we are working to reach people that want to or feel the need to try to improve themselves in some way, shape, or form, that are struggling with different things. There are even universities that hire recreational therapists, and they will work with their students on their campus, which I think is an amazing piece. Our primarily recreational therapists, we do work in hospitals, but we also work in summer camps. We work with park and rec departments. We work in physical rehab hospitals. We work in substance use facilities. The number one employer of recreational therapists is the VA system. And so we have lots and lots of recreational therapists that are working with our veterans on a variety of different issues, whether that be substance use, mental health, whether that be physical rehab. We recreational therapists are working with a really wide variety of people across a really wide variety of settings. And I think that's one of the things that I know drew me to recreational therapy, and I hope draws other people to recreational therapy as well, that breadth of people that you could be working with, places where you could be working, and the things that you could be doing. I did interventions that ranged from, having people on a ropes course to having people taking them out to go roller skating. And so the variety of different types of activities that we can do is pretty endless as we consider the population, the people that we work with.
So in your time with EDRU, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Yeah, I think, I've been with EDRU. I started with EDRU in 2014. I was elected to the board of directors at that point in time as a member at large. And then I went to, we needed to have somebody fill the treasurer role. And so I ended up moving into that role, served as the treasurer until 2019. And then since 2019, I've been serving as the executive director. And so across that time, we've had an opportunity to see a lot of really, really neat things happen across our profession. I think to things like we had COVID, obviously that's a horrific time and people going through just really, really challenging things, but watching the recreational therapy and what EDRU was doing at that point, we were able to pull together a lot of materials for recreational therapists to use in a different type of way because we weren't able to meet with clients in the way that we were used to being able to meet with them. We were able to, we created our largest conference that we've ever done. We had over 1,000 people attend our virtual conference during COVID, and that just brought recreational therapists together. During that time, we also had a kind of one of our first posts on social media go truly viral. At that point, Governor Cuomo in New York was doing a press conference, and he was identifying essential personnel, and he, on the screen, on TV, on CNN, it says, recreational therapists, we are listed there as essential personnel, and so we were able to capture that and share it out, and it was a lot of validation, I think, of what we do. On a much more personal level, as far as kind of a real success and kind of recognition of what we do, I was traveling about a year ago, and it had been a long day of travel. I'd been to a couple of conferences and meetings, and I was checking into my hotel and was just ready to go to bed, just tired and wanted to go to bed and didn't want to have a lot of conversation with people. And so I was at the registration desk checking in, and the woman said, she was very, very outgoing and excited to talk. And I was in the opposite place. And she says to me, what are you here for? And I was like, oh, gosh, let me try and give a really short answer to this. And so I said, I'm here for a conference, figuring that would kind of be the end of the conversation. That didn't stop her at all. And she says, oh, really? She's like, what conference are you here for? And I said, well, I know, like in my mind, I'm saying, I know how I can end this conversation now. I said, I'm in recreational therapy, expecting her to say, oh, and that kind of be the end of it. Her response was so vastly different. When I said I was here for a recreational therapy conference, she says, oh my gosh, I love recreational therapy. I think that what you do is absolutely amazing. She says, at this point in time, I'm blown away and I realize I've got to completely change everything. And I'm like, I want to engage with this woman and have a good conversation with her. As it turns out, she has 2 children. And they both had been receiving recreational therapy services from a young age. I was in Indiana. In Indiana, they can provide recreational therapy services and cover the cost of those through a Medicaid waiver. And as a result, she had long, extensive experience with recreational therapy. It was just so amazing an interaction where I was like, what we do matters. People really do benefit from the services that we provide. People, we really are out there changing people's lives. It was just a totally unexpected interaction and a really, really powerful interaction at the same time.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep.
Thanks. It's true, my friends. All of us have something to say, whether we have a disability or not. The more we try to understand each other's messages and way of thinking, the more we grow as a community. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.